back, Holly. Happy to be with you again.
Thank you. Stoked to be back.
Fabulous. How is life? Where are you? You're our nomad. So where are you located currently?
This week, I'm back in the Northern Rivers, so back in the country. And I mean, not the country of Australia, haven't left the country, but I'm back in more rural Australia, which feels really nice after being a bit of a city slicker for the last 6 months. It's super nice to wake up in the morning to like a cow mooing as opposed to like a tram and like sirens.
Someone leaning on a horn. We almost crossed paths. I've been a bit of a nomad myself. I've been down the coast. I've been down to Melbourne. I'm heading back down the coast today. But we didn't cross paths. I hadn't been to Melbourne in like 6 years and forgot how much I love it down there. It is just such an amazing city. It really, I mean, close your ears, Sydney-siders. It really is superior to Sydney in so many ways.
I fall in love with it every time I'm there. Just totally immerse myself in like the art culture and go to comedy shows all the time and eat croissants. Mm. And you just really like romanticize like the grunginess of it, I think, is what I do.
It's definitely got some major, major advantages over Sydney, but I'm probably just had my citizenship of Sydney revoked for saying that. So today we're going to be doing a bit of a Q&A, a bit of a mixed bag as far as the questions that we got back. Some of them are sort of more so about our experience. Some of them are more general recovery questions. There's a lot of questions, so this isn't the last time we'll be doing this. So I got these from followers over on Instagram, and we'll jump straight in with a question about exercise, because I don't think we've really touched on a lot of exercise in our chats together. So Holly, what was your experience with exercise during recovery versus after?
I feel like I'd almost even break it into three different categories of before I went into recovery, what it looked like in recovery, and then post-recovery, because realistically, prior to recovery, my experience with exercise looked very much like spiking my cortisol levels at a very early hour of the morning, doing high intense exercise and then not feeling my body correctly and then wondering why I'm exhausted all the time. And then I think obviously my relationship with exercise in recovery changed dramatically. And for me, it was really inconsistent, which it needed to be, because I was working really hard to separate the movement from being this thing that gave me structure and predictability. So for me, in my unique experience, I really had to invite in a lot of flexibility and become really adaptable to consistent changes with movement, because that really was the best medicine for my relationship with it. And then being able to find that structure and predictability in other ways that are more aligned, like a morning journaling practice, in ways that like weren't damaging to myself. But now I would say my relationship with exercise, more so movement, I would say, than exercise, is still super inconsistent. And I love it that way. I was thinking about it this morning, and I feel like it's quite seasonal, I would say, my relationship with movement. I mean, at the moment I'm near the beach, so loving to catch a wave. But realistically, that's also sometimes not possible. I think particularly like surfing is a huge part of my life, but it actually forces you to be really, really flexible, because realistically, I've tried to surf 3 times this weekend. There's been north winds and I've gone to the beach and been like, it's just not happening. It's just not, we're going to get a coffee instead. It's just not happening. Yeah. So I think it's ever changing, and I love it that way. Like in winter, I'm super slow, love a slow morning, would very much prioritize like reading a book and having a cup of tea, may go for a walk later because it's a good thing to do, but it's not a priority for me. Yes, realistically, you and I both sit on our bums all day like on the computer, so it is important to move our bodies, but if I'm feeling unwell or if I have quite a busy social schedule or work schedule, it's kind of the first thing to go for me, realistically. So I love it, but it's a part of my life. It is not, and that's all it is, literally just a part.
Beautiful. I think I didn't think about it like that, but I definitely have a before, during, and after relationship with movement, like before my eating disorder, during, and after. And before my eating disorder, because, you know, I've talked before about the fact that I was quite heavily bullied in primary school, like for my size, movement was a really awful thing for me growing up, because it felt like it put a magnifying glass on me even more than there already was. So I hated movement. I would dread like field days and swimming carnivals and all that sort of stuff. And then as I went into high school and I went to boarding school halfway through high school, I started running and walking and getting into sport there, which I really enjoyed because I did it with my friends and the environment there was just completely different and really wonderful. And it really felt like a bonding experience and something to be social around. And then when my eating disorder started, it became a huge part of my identity. Like it was kind of like I was trying to erase younger Mia and be like, I'm a runner and I'm fit and I'm this and I'm that. And it was like almost my first descriptor that I would meet people with when they'd ask me about like who I was as a person. And it was really, really important to me to be seen in that way. But I still didn't feel like I'd earned it, which is so eating disorder, right? Like it doesn't matter how much you do or how hard you push or whatever, it's never, ever, ever going to really feel like you're worthy or deserving. And then after recovery, mine is much like yours. And during recovery as well, inconsistent, very seasonal, very much geared towards supporting my body in terms of what it can do with a chronic illness, that sometimes movement is really, really good for me, like yoga and gentle walks and hiking, getting sort of fluid moving around my body, because that's a big part of my inflammation is, you know, just fluid sitting and it doesn't feel nice after an extended period of time. And then periods where that is not appropriate, that is not the best way to support my body. So kind of like with the surf with you, like the ocean and nature is telling you when you're going to get in the water, my body is telling me what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. And it's never, well, I've decided and my body just has to go along with it. It's, you know, my first check-in is what is the best thing I need to do to support my body today. So yeah, I think that it's, if you choose to have a relationship with movement, it's going to look quite different, quite likely than how it looked when you are unwell.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because we are always evolving and ever-changing, of course, our relationship with movement should absolutely mirror that. And I get such a pang in my heart when you talk about that younger version of yourself, that child version of yourself, just hating exercise, because I was so the same. I was very unconscious. I was very just aware of my body in high school. And like, if there was a beep test, you can bet that I was getting my mum to write me a note. I was like, forgot my shoes. Because it was genuinely,
I just broke out into a cold sweat when you said beep test.
It's like literally
I've forgotten about the beep test.
It's such a cruel thing to do. It's like, who's going to be the first to drop out?
Yep.
It is so hectic. And I remember I was saying, so like, tense. Cross country. Obviously, I was hiding in the bathroom. And I remember the worst thing happened one year. Like a bunch of girlfriends and I, it was like three of us. We like ditched the, what's it called? You wagged the running carnival. Didn't want to do it. I was just so insecure. I was like, I don't want to have to run this 4K.
I wagged a swimming carnival too. I was like, I'm going to get a swimmer in front of all these girls. Are you kidding me?
But you know what then happened? We were like, okay, cool. So we're just going to pop out at the end. Close to like when everyone's finishing, popped out too early, got fourth. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be sent to the next level. I'm going to be sent to the next level. Hasn't broken a sweat, hair down. I think this was the first time in my life I felt deep guilt, deep guilt. And I had to complain. And obviously they already knew, they were just waiting for me to do the right thing.
For those,
the stress of it.
Yeah. For those not aware, the beep test is something that they get you to do in like physical education class where, you know, it might be like a basketball court and they're getting you to run from one end to the other and there's a beep going off and the beep gets faster, like there's shorter intervals between each beep and you have to get to the end of the court before the next beep goes. And it's like, it's very Hunger Games-ish. No one's laughing. It's not fun or funny. It's like kill or be killed. This is a zero sum game. And I would just be like ambling down the court at the first beep and go, I'd be like, oh no, I've got to go and sit on the sideline. Sorry.
People are like falling over, diving for it. And then there's someone with a clipboard being like, no, out, out, out. And you're like, okay, that's it.
And there was no prize at the end of it. Like there was no other than like, I don't know, the pride of winning the beep test, but there was no great incentive to engage in this. So for any overseas
literally none
may not know what the beep test is, that's how we approach or introduce movement to children in Australia. This is a good one. How were you able to push through the big dips in motivation in recovery?
I think for me, just knowing who I am as a person, phases of stabilizing were really important to me. I'm just someone who needs a lot of time to process and integrate and get really grounded in steps that I've made before making the next leap forward. So my recovery was sort of like, you know, make lots of progress. Let's just sit here for a hot minute and like, let's do it again. And then let's just sit here. And I think that really supported me having space for the times where I didn't have motivation. Cause I like to think of motivation like an emotion. It's going to come, it's going to go, it's going to come, it's going to go. If you are coming into this expecting to have motivation all the time, Dials, it's going to be a little bit difficult. It's just not going to happen. And also if you're sitting on the couch and you're so unmotivated to do the housework that you have to do, and you're waiting for the motivation to happen, you're going to be sitting on the couch for about 3 days. Uh-huh. You need to just think about what is the one thing that I can do to kickstart the motivation and get the action happening, knowing that the motivation will always come back. This is like the happiness will always come back. Every positive emotion will always come back. We just got to sit in these ones sometimes and not thinking it's a disaster. I feel like people almost have this fear of motivation and they feel unmotivated, and then they have this like attachment to being like, this is really bad and things are going really bad. It's like, it's not the reality. It's literally just not feeling motivated. And it's almost necessary to feel unmotivated sometimes.
Yeah. I love that you said, you know, I don't push myself or force myself. It's something that we've referred to before. It's like that tough love measure of like, do I need a push or do I need to rest? Like I had a client reach out to me recently who really hit a wall emotionally with something much bigger, like not much bigger, but something like a life event that was big, right? And reached out to me feeling really bad that she hadn't been able to do X, Y, Z in recovery. And I just went, you did exactly what you need to do. You reached out, you told me what's going on, you established boundaries, you said what you needed, and you're meeting those needs. Like sometimes the answer is not actually to push forward. It's to lean back into whatever you're feeling so that it can have its full journey and then be over. And then you can move into the next stage as opposed to prolonging suffering. Right. And yeah, I think that sometimes when people send these questions, because I've had this question quite a few times over the last 10 years and mine has incrementally changed, where they're looking for like the magic, like a book or a saying or a skill. And it's like, sometimes the answer is that there is no answer, that it actually doesn't need a fix. When clients are expressing that they're really tired and burnt out and lacking motivation, my answer is never to like push them and push them. It's always to meet them where they are. That's our like main job in our, you know, coaching work, is to meet people where they are. We don't just have a cookie cutter program that we shove them into. So if I can tell that they're burning out, what we do is we come up with three lists. The first one is maintenance and management. That's what it's called. The first one is, what do we need to maintain? Like, what have we already worked on that we need to keep in rotation? Like, obviously if they're on a meal plan, the meal plan doesn't change, but we're not going to add anything. We're not going to expand on any of those challenges. If they're doing a certain amount of movement, that will not increase. We're not going to, you know, increase anything we're currently doing. If we're still doing appointments, then we're still agreeing to go to appointments. And then we do a list of red flags. What are things that we need to look out for to see that, you know, eating disorder might be using this rest period to claw its way back in? Like it's, you know, taking little bits out of snacks or meals, or it's wanting to cancel appointments or whatever it might be. And then the third list is action plan, which is really just like, reach out to me, reach out to other team members, maybe tell a loved one, try to get back into some of the skills that we use, like dialoguing, et cetera, but most importantly, reaching out. So the answer very often is do nothing. Do what you're currently doing and don't do anymore, and wait for that motivation to come back. Because I love how you put that, like happiness will come back. All of these emotions and experiences and states are cyclical. It will come back. But I think the more we force it, the more we prolong whatever state we're currently in, because we're not letting whatever is happening just be and have its season and work its way out of our system.
Yeah. And I think it's also I agree with that so much. And I think it's also an opportunity to address your relationship with productivity and actually being like, rest is so productive. Mm-hmm. It's actually imperative in this experience as well, because showing up every day and doing this hard cognitive work and challenging behaviors and having to stay present with yourself, like this is a full-time job. Plus a lot of people also have full-time jobs or children or households to run or are studying, all these things. It is so important to rest. And I know this comes up with a lot of my clients often, of being like, again, like I feel like I didn't meet these goals or I didn't do this. It's like, but what actually is working? What also did we achieve? Mm-hmm. Because if you can achieve everything that we achieved last week, cool, we're stabilizing. That's okay. That's okay. It's really important. If we're communicating openly about it, great. You're already doing something differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I just quite naturally took the same approach you did. Because I didn't know a lot about recovery. I think that was a real hindrance and also a help, because I didn't have expectations of myself of like how long this should take or what I should be doing. Whereas now I do see, especially, you know, there is so much benefit to things like the online recovery community, et cetera, but it also does bring around a lot of comparison for clients where they're like, I should be where they are. I should be doing what they're doing. And it's like, I could not put two clients next to each other who I've worked with over the last almost 7 years and say that they're even similar, let alone identical. So whatever this is going to look like for you in terms of, yeah, maybe sometimes having to hang out in certain areas of recovery or having to repeat certain goals so that you really feel like they're cemented in, that's your process. There is no timeline here. There is no, failing the program, because it's meant to be tailored to you as an individual.
That's just the journey of life.
Recovery is a crash course in being a person.
I think like some of the best advice I was ever given, this isn't really recovery advice, it's just kind of like life advice, particularly when you're in your 20s. I think it's so easy, particularly if you've come from an eating disorder as well, to just want to like plan and have things figured out and like, this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. But realistically, your journey of recovery, you can't define it like set in stone, this is what's going to happen, because you don't know what's going to be going on in your life. Because realistically, in your 20s, like, you might fall in love, you might fall out of love, something might happen, you might move house, like a pet might die, you might have this great new group of friends you want to spend more time with. Like there's so many different moving parts. Yeah. So it's almost a bit of an injustice to yourself to be like, we're going to do this by this date and this by this date and this by this date. Like we know the direction we're going in and we know what we need to do to get there. But let's just be a little bit flexy with it.
Oh my God, like what I thought my life was going to be when I was 20, like I didn't have the capacity to imagine anything other than that, because I was 20, but also like I couldn't have imagined how much better it could be. Like life had to sort of direct that. Do you know what I mean? Like the ideas and plans you have for yourself might actually not be as cool as the random twists and turns of life and where that's going to lead you.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly.
Tricky sort of one here, because obviously it's down to the individual, but how to help a friend or a loved one who doesn't want to recover?
I think this is so sensitive, because you have to remember that your friend is most likely going through a really intense inner battle. And I think the approach needs to be really based on the individual. Mm-hmm. But I would say, firstly, probably just try to create an environment where your friend feels like it is safe to be vulnerable and honest and open when they're ready. Mm-hmm. And even maybe start by offering indirect support. So that looks like being a good example, shutting down unhelpful conversation topics, using positive self-talk, be available, and try to continue to support without trying to micromanage or force or pressure, despite the frustration you may feel, because what you want to avoid is the person shutting down to the point where they will avoid further attempts at support. And it is really tricky, because if someone doesn't want to recover at all, it's going to be really difficult to see change, particularly lasting change. But if someone has a hint of desire or curiosity or willingness to take steps forward in the direction of their healing, that is totally something you can work with. Mm-hmm. But if you are very concerned with someone's behaviors and you feel like their mental state is really in a really vulnerable place, it is so important to say something, but ensuring that you are coming from a place of compassion, I would say.
Absolutely. I think one of the clearest delineations of where this can get complicated is, you know, what if it's your child? Like what if it's an underage individual where you have so much input into their medical care and, you know, how they're going to interact with treatment, et cetera, or whether they should interact with treatment. And obviously if this is a parent going to your like local foundation, a trusted GP, just to first talk to them about what that could look like and what are some of the best approaches to maybe engaging that child in treatment in a way that where they're collaborative, right? So many stories that I've heard from clients where coming to me is kind of the first time they've owned their own recovery and feel like they're in a collaborative mindset because it feels like treatment has been forced upon them, which obviously sometimes as parents, we feel we got to do what we got to do. And, you know, the safety of our children is the most important thing, obviously, but trying to keep the process as collaborative as possible and encouraging sort of that curiosity from that person themselves. Now, if it's somebody who is an adult, I totally agree with you. There is no magical thing you can say. There is no magical resource you can introduce them to. There is no single person you can sit them down with who is going to inject them with the desire to recover. I think sometimes people come to me and they say to me, Mia, I want you to make my daughter want to recover. And I'm like, I can't do that. I'm not magical. You cannot make somebody want to recover. But as you beautifully put it, you can create an environment which allows for those conversations to be had if that's something that that person is interested in discussing at some point, making sure that you are available, emotionally available, available as far as creating a space that's non-judgmental, that isn't putting any expectations on them. Because I think that it can be really difficult to be close to somebody who has an eating disorder. I know that, you know, we've talked about issues that I've had with, you know, friends and family members and how difficult it was for them to be in my life and remain in my life as I got more and more unwell. It can be really, really challenging. The best advice I can ever give is like, don't ever give up. Have your feelings, absolutely don't feel that you can't have support and have your feelings and frustrations validated. But as far as the undercurrent of the tone that you're sending to that person, the impression you're giving them, the undercurrent must always be, I'm always here. I will never, ever, ever give up, whether or not you choose to embark on recovery or otherwise. For me, I'm always going to keep it on the table for you. I'm going to hold on to the hope until hopefully you want to pick it up yourself.
And I think even someone hearing those words, it really creates just such a safe environment to be like, okay, I feel supported. I feel like I'm held in this space, but also sort of putting it back on them being like, everyone is an autonomous adult, not everyone, but those who are adults. Yes. And you have to take responsibility for your healing and no one can force you to do that. But if you are the friend who is concerned, another thing I would say is you just need to be really careful to look after yourself as well, because you are giving, if you are giving and giving and giving and it's not being received, that could be really exhausting. And that could be the point where you're like, hands off, fine, I'm not doing it. You're on your own. That's what we want to avoid.
Yes.
So it's just like, let's just tread lightly. No one go into burnout.
Yeah. And I mean, gently, you know, maybe putting a video in front of them or a podcast and saying, no obligation to listen to this, no obligation to watch this, but just wanted to put this in your path in case, you know, you got a spare 10 minutes. And again, without any expectations, because you're just keeping that door open for them to walk through should they ever come to a point where they are ready. They have somewhere to go where they know you're going to be able to meet them where they are. And again, with no judgment or no expectations. But it is really, really, it's not easy to watch somebody and feel like, oh, I have the answers and I could, you know, help guide you towards something better for yourself. But you know, we've got to treat people as autonomous individuals, like you said.
Yeah. And I would also just another extra point is if you're not informed, really inform yourself about eating disorders and what that other person might be going through, because beautiful. I think it can feel really confusing and jarring, being like, I don't get it. If you don't understand the nuances of an eating disorder and what someone is going through and you think it might just be like about the food and body image, I could see how frustration could build easier.
Yes.
As opposed to being like, actually educate yourself on what's actually going on for this person behind the behaviors.
Completely. And sometimes, you know, I'll quite often I'll have parents and partners and carers and friends reach out to me wanting to do a session with them, and I'm not seeing their loved one, like their loved one is not a client of mine, but they do, they just want some information. And they kind of, I often say that those of us with lived experience, especially working in the space, we're kind of like interpreters. We can talk over the fence. Like I understand the language their loved one is speaking, and I understand what the carer or loved one or friend is trying to communicate. And it's all just getting lost in translation. But yes, trying to explain to them from kind of the outside in what that person is going through. And, you know, at Beyond Body, we are working towards providing more services to sort of like parents, carers, friends, partners, etc. In fact, our training is about that tomorrow, because there is such a need for it, because we do know that the loved ones of somebody going through an eating disorder need support and guidance and a bit of help as well. Does being a recovery coach ever trigger old eating disorder thoughts?
This is a great question, because I get asked by this by clients all the time, because the reality is you and I are in environments every single day where we're talking about eating disorder thoughts and behaviors and emotions and scenarios. But
do we ever talk about anything else?
I mean, occasionally. Sometimes. But not really. I don't know, just being so intimately involved with someone else's experience of their eating disorder and accompanied struggles and suffering with that, it really solidifies my recovery work, because I so deeply believe what I say. Mm-hmm. And I often do think of my clients as, when I'm talking to them, as things that I wish, you know, I had been able to say to my younger self. I think because their, you know, my past experience is their current experience. And so I think the words I offer and the work we do, it holds so much potency, because I believe it with my entire being. So I actually think it works in the opposite way. I guess I would say, like, being a recovery coach is kind of like the ultimate exposure therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. And I mean, obviously there's so many guardrails in place, especially with the Carolyn Costin Institute, that you need to be recovered for 2 years, that the training is very, very clear about, you know, if this is bringing up XYZ for you, then, you know, this is something that you need to reflect on and, you know, go back to CCI about, et cetera. So there's all these pit stops along the way, which are basically putting up a sign saying, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? As you sort of move through the training. But I feel exactly the same way. I really felt, especially in the first couple of years of working, that it was just incredibly affirming to the fact that I was fully recovered, and that it did really solidify that belief and that feeling. And now I'm more so at a stage of my recovery where I actually forget a lot of my eating disorder in detail, like from my own, I do remember like XYZ happened, but I don't feel as connected to it. And so sometimes I'll be seeing a new client and they'll have something in their behavioral profile that I haven't spoken about with clients for a long time. And I'll be like, oh my God, I used to do that too. Oh yeah. Like I know exactly what you're talking about. I know the feeling you're talking about. And, you know, and the shame and guilt comes afterwards, and you can kind of hop back into those memories, but it feels like it's really drifted out to the outer edges. I understand where this question comes from. And I understand it when clients are asking us as well, like they're checking in with our boundaries, et cetera. And I'll be really honest with them and say, look, you know, this is not to say I'm bulletproof and I'm not human. This doesn't trigger me. But let's say, for instance, after my father passed away, if a client was bringing up a lot of things around grief, et cetera, which we're not really trained to address, so I would always point that back to their therapist, but I would have to verbally kind of express a boundary, because before going through trauma therapy, it was not sort of productive or safe for me to be having those conversations with clients, even, you know, not in any great depth, but even, you know, through dialogues, et cetera, I just really have to express that going into any detail about really traumatic stuff related to grief was just not productive for me at that time. So it's not that we're inhuman. It's not that we don't have certain things that we might be, you know, sensitive to at certain times. I know that I've spoken with other coaches who have to have some of those boundaries around other things. But no, certainly not in the eating disorder department. And it's kind of, I remember when I went to America, when Dad was unwell and we were taking care of him, and I would do Q&As on Instagram and stuff when I was over there, and I always got the question, with everything that you're going through, are you afraid that you might relapse? And my immediate internal, like, visceral reaction was like, excuse my language, like, fuck no. Like, that would never be a solution. I can't, with everything that I have going on, I can't imagine adding the complexity and the darkness and the out of control chaos of my eating disorder back into the mix? Absolutely not. So it's, yeah, it just feels like such a far removed experience, or you feel so far removed from any belief you ever had that it's a solution, that it's ever going to make you feel better.
The longer you are recovered, if, you know, if I was to relapse, it's not just a relapse. It's also, I don't get this life anymore. And I love this life now. I'm so grateful for the life that I've been able to create post-recovery. It's like, I would never give that up, ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't think that any of us who say that we're fully recovered are naive. Like I say now confidently, and I say with each year, my confidence grows around, I can't envision an experience or a state or a period of my life where that would happen, where there would be, you know, sort of this big door opening up to an eating disorder again. Also because of so many of the things we talked about in other podcasts, just like that recovery requires like drastically changing your life and drastically changing your coping mechanisms and your boundaries and all these things which, you know, support being able to remain safe and healthy long term. And especially because I've been through some of the worst times of my life post being recovered. And again, the answer was hell no. If you're working with a coach or somebody with lived experience, it's totally understandable and okay to kind of check in with their boundaries. But I would hope that if you're working with somebody with lived experience, they're pretty confidently in a place where what you're sharing with them is not going to trigger that person.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I feel like this question kind of could lead into why did you become a coach? Okay, so I think when I recovered, obviously it changed my life in terms of, you know, how I related to food and my body and myself on a day-to-day basis. But once I was in like maintenance phase of recovery, the work of recovery, it continued to just help me question life. And I think my general experience, because in reality, I learned so much in recovery that it opened me up to all these other areas where maybe I had also been living a little bit passively and not in alignment. Mm. And in that way, recovery helped me just understand who I am and how I move in the world and what I want and what keeps me well and what throws me off balance and how I want to spend my time and who I want to share my energy with. And I think then being able to, the progression of my recovery was then being able to, you know, use those skills, life skills, such as self-inquiry and honesty and emotional regulation and a deep level of self-trust. And they helped, those things helped me get really, really clear on a few simple things that I think really redirected me in life. And the things that I knew for sure were that I wanted to be happy and that I wanted to live with meaning and that I wanted to give meaning back into the world. And I had absolutely no clue how I was going to action any of these things yet, but I had the idea of them and that felt strong enough. So I actually wasn't, you know, I didn't go through coaching with you and was like, cool, I'm going to be a coach at the end of this. Like I didn't have that idea. Maybe it came to me once and then I lost it, but I sat with it. I didn't have it at all really for a few years. And I think it wasn't until I came to the realization of these few things, few core truths that I really wanted in my life that felt super, super important, that the idea of becoming a recovery coach came back to me and it felt like something I should really investigate. And even that at that time, I had no idea how special this work would be and how much I could care about what I'm doing. Because, you know, obviously from my own experience of going through recovery and having a coach, I believe in coaching in this work. I believe in full recovery and I very much believe in supporting someone from lived experience and supporting just with that behavioral outpatient coaching as a very key support in recovery. So I think there's a million reasons why I became a coach, but I think for me, above all else, it aligned with everything that I found out that I wanted in my life from my experience of recovery.
Yeah, I think your position in sort of the coaching field and like within Beyond Body, but within CCI more broadly is really interesting and valuable because you would be a very rare case where you've had both. Like you've had the role of being coached and you've had the role of being a coach. Like you really can speak, like when we're doing retreat discovery calls or, you know, we're talking about coaching with them, I'm always throwing to you and being like, Holly actually has the most insight here and the most amazing thing to share because she can speak from both sides of the experience. So you have, yeah, you hold a very, very unique kind of perspective, I think. I became a coach because I was obviously working in the field within sort of advocacy. I had been running the channel, working in finance, which was not advisable, but it had done its job for almost a decade, and had actually just then gone to work for a theatre producer. And I hated that job. And at the same time, I was going around doing some speaking things with Butterfly. This is before I became their ambassador officially. And they mentioned to me, have you heard of what Carolyn Costin's doing? She's got the Carolyn Costin Institute. Like, she's introducing coaching. And I was like, what is this? So obviously I had been doing all these videos and all this content in my spare time, not being paid a thing for it. YouTube certainly wasn't paying me anything for years and years and years. And now here was this way to actually directly impact somebody's recovery. It was always very cool to get comments being like, your videos really helped me, or, you know, my family and I watch your videos together every week. And that was great. But what I really loved was like when I would go to events and people would come up to me and be like, Mia, I have been following your channel, and being able to have a longer conversation with them about like their experience and their hope and their motivation. So when I heard about the coaching thing and then finally got the opportunity to dive in, I knew that I would love it. But like you, I think I vastly underestimated how much I would love it. It really touches every single interest that I have, every expression that I ever wanted in a job. I went to university for journalism and had to drop out because of my eating disorder, because I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to be an investigative journalist. I wanted to talk about the underdog and things that people didn't understand. And I get to do that every day, like one-on-one, and more broadly with sort of the stuff that I talk about online. So yeah, it just, without knowing it, it just sort of ticked every box of, if I could create a job for myself, like this would be it.
Yeah. It's funny that you went into uni kind of wanting to tell stories and to have that investigating role. And it's like, it wasn't the manifestation of being a journalist, but right, like you looped back to that.
Totally. Like even, you know, friends of mine who ended up being reporters and being journalists, they were like, you get to do what you want to do. Like you have full freedom of expression. You have people who are plugged into what you're saying. You don't have anybody telling you, you can't do this or you can't do that. And you can't say this and you can't say that. So yeah, it's kind of what we were talking about before. Sometimes you got to let life surprise you, because at 20, I thought my life was over because I was dropping out of university and could never have imagined that that was going to be an essential step in where I was going to end up, you know, 15 years later.
Totally. And at that age as well, when you're 20, like those decisions feel like they are the end of the world. And realistically, then I think when you get older, you veer close to 30, 40, you're like, I mean, if you make the wrong decision, you just guess again, guys.
Guess again. It's really fine. Choose your own adventure. Just like double back and make a different choice. That's so true. Like I do love having clients in their early 20s because, you know, at 35, there's just so much hindsight. And, you know, of course, you're not going to believe it until you go through it yourself, but just encouraging them to like, take the pressure down and have some bloody fun. Like truly, there is nothing you can do right now that's really going to stuff it up that majorly. Especially if you're on the track of like doing some really great healing work and getting through recovery.
Yeah. Just fun. I feel like it's so important.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we do the hobby question to finish? Cause it's fun.
Yeah.
This question is, your favorite hobby post recovery, what could we look forward to? I literally love whoever asked this question because I feel like I'm the queen of hobbies. I love Hobbs. I have hobbies for days.
I love Hobbs. I love that.
Because I think recovery is this cool thing where you get, it kind of like reintegrates you with your creativity and joy and expression and being able to fully engage in activities. Whereas like in my eating disorder, I couldn't fully engage in anything because I was just so in my mind. So I think that's a really beautiful thing about recovery, being like, oh, I can actually be present in something, and hobbies are where it's at.
Totally.
I think having hobbies is so important because there's so few things. I feel like I'm so passionate about this.
I love how excited you are about hobbies. It's amazing.
So few things in adulthood where that we get to do where there's less expectation and like little to no monetary reward. I mean, obviously this depends on your approach to hobbies, but in my world, this is definitely my approach to it, where we just get to be curious and make mistakes and learn and embrace play. Because no one in our life, like when you were children, no one had to teach you how to play. But then in adulthood, I think we need reminding that we deserve to play, and that's actually this really important, I would say, essential component to life, because it is so easy to take life so seriously, particularly when you're in your eating disorder, even in recovery, because like, man, that stuff is so serious all the time. And it's hard to just be fun and expressive and creative and let go and be silly. And I feel like trying out new things and kind of almost having the expectation that you're going to be shit at it is great. Mm-hmm. Hobbies that are in my, I would say, rotation at the moment, I always try to have a creative practice. Recently being in Melbourne was like, did a few semesters of a new ceramics course. I like writing and painting. I always loop back to painting was a really big part of my recovery. Have also dabbled in mosaicing, embroidering, like baking, sourdough, obviously surfing. I feel like I'm on, what are those things called?
A bachelor.
I feel like a speed date.
Yeah.
And I tried this.
I've got 30 seconds with you. Let me tell you about all my hobbies.
These are all my hobbies. I guess my hobbies are sort of like mixed between like something that is like intimate, that's my own thing, that's just a form of expression, and then also something that's like community fun play. So that could be like doing a random dance class, or I run a book club. No one wants to be in a book club. We do this monthly. Yeah. So just like, it's a great thing to mix up, particularly when you have a job, as we do, which most of the time is quite serious. Mm-hmm. It's really good to also have these things to balance. And it's like, this is literally just for fun. This is literally just to, you know, it's super important for us to do like the real hard cognitive work, but also it's so important to do things that keep your soul alive. And for me, hobbies are that.
Beautiful. Love that. Yeah, I am the same. I always have like some creative outlet going. I love writing. I've always loved sort of writing fiction. My grandparents held on to like these stories that I used to write when I was 4, and they obviously make absolutely no sense, but they just go on for pages and pages and pages. Cause my dad was a big reader and writer. He like would read with us all the time. He would like set me up at his laptop so I could like write stories, and was just always so encouraging of that stuff. And I you know, that flow state that we're always trying to, you know, impart to people and explain, and it really can't be explained. When I am in like a storytelling phase of like just into hours of sitting and writing something, that is like my greatest sense of like just zen, like nirvana, like just not on this planet, right? Just totally calm, but activated in a really nice way, not like overstimulated. Yes. It's the most, and it just like pours out, right? It's the most incredible feeling. And I was the same in my eating disorder. I really dropped a lot of those like creative outlets and pursuits and hobbies and practices because I judged myself for them. Cause I'm quite a dork. Like I love a lot of fantasy stuff. Like I love Buffy the Vampire Slayer, even though that's not actually just about vampires. It's just one big metaphor for all the trials and tribulations we go through in life. And it has people doing doctorates about it at Oxford University. I'm going to stop defending my favorite show now. But I'm quite a nerd. Like during the pandemic, only Josie knows about this. During the pandemic, I have this secret YouTube channel. Like, you know, when people make fan videos?
Where are you going with this? What are you about to say?
I'm not going to tell you.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
Take the TV show. But during the pandemic, I made a bunch of fan videos for this one TV show, and they have like over 1 million views on them. And nobody but Josie knows about it. I send them to her because she's like, oh my God, I love fan videos. I was like, you love fan videos? Have I got the channel for you? And like just putting together like clips of the show and a song, and it's so daggy and dorky and no one's ever going to know about it. And it's the best feeling to just be like, this is for nothing. This is not never going to be anything. It doesn't have to be anything. The point of it is to be nothing but just some silly like downtime and just switching my brain off. Love hiking. I consider that like a hobby and something that I use as like connection and sort of getting back with people socially, all kinds of stuff that was really, really important to me before I went into, like, before I became unwell. And so much of my awakening in recovery was just unleashing the nerd and just dropping all the judgment and just allowing myself to have, like, these silly, playful, like, childish expressions, like letting loose, listening to the Taylor Swift Eras Tour set list and dancing around the apartment. I do that almost every day. That's usually how I start my day. I would have judged myself so harshly for something like that when I was unwell. I would have started dancing and been like, you're a dickhead, stop, like, what are you doing? Well, and it's like, really? that voice just doesn't exist anymore.
And this really speaks to authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just accepting yourself for everything that you enjoy and not shaming yourself for things that, like, maybe you actually do enjoy and it's fun. Because I think that silliness is the most underrated human quality.
Yeah.
It is so important just to literally practice kind of looking like a fool sometimes. I think some of the most, this is how I would describe a beautiful person. Like, some of the most beautiful people in my life are people who are just so authentically and messily themselves. And a couple of my best friends are the silliest people you would ever meet. And it has been so amazing to be around those people that bring that out in me. Cause naturally that isn't my, like, default, like, can do it, but yeah, not like, it doesn't come as naturally to me. So being around people who are just can let loose and be silly and be this beautiful expression of themselves, that is just, that energy is so addictive. It's so nice to be around that. It just oozes positivity. It's beautiful. So I feel like if you're thinking about jumping into hobbies, I feel like we've given it a very good wrap.
And look, not expensive. You just chuck on Taylor Swift and throw yourself around the house. Fabulous. I've loved this. I hope that we got to some of your questions. We will definitely do this again. And feel free, as always, to send across any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to talk about. But yeah, lovely to see your face as always. We actually, I should mention, because I'll pop it in here at the end, we have just launched dates for the second Molly Mook Beyond Body Retreat in April of 2024. It'll be from the 4th to the 8th in Molly Mook Beach on the south coast of New South Wales. I will put the promo at the end. I will have links to the event and how to get in touch with us about it. If you'd like to do a discovery call, that is the next step. You get in touch with us, we book a call, we give you some more information, and then we go from there. But we have our first one coming up in November, which is very exciting. I've got literally all the stuff for our guest tote bag sitting next to me here, which is very, very exciting to get to put those things together. But yeah, if you're interested in joining us for April, don't hesitate to get in touch.
Amazing. We're so excited.
Very, very, very. All right, everybody. We will see you again soon in the next episode. Thanks, Holly.
Bye. Thank you.